So in theoretical cosmology, we've been working a lot on theoretical models and what the implications are in terms of cosmological data. And we've entered this precision era in cosmology where we know that lambda CDM is a great fit to data. But the truth is that we don't understand 95% of the ingredients in that model. We don't understand what lambda is. We don't understand what cold dark matter is. And there's been a huge effort in developing infrared theories of modified gravity that try to explain what the universe is doing right now, why it's presently under current acceleration. And it's my firm belief that if the precision era has taught us anything at all, is that the theory needs to do a better job at trying to get to the precision levels that we now are able to attain, like with the Planck satellite. So what do I mean by the precision? So it's true that with observations, we are basically allowing ourselves to constrain parameters of a given theory that people can propose. And with the theory, we can have predictions that then we can test with observations. But already at the level of the theory, it's possible to prepare it even before it meets our observations by asking some questions about the theory itself. Is the theory even self-consistent? At what scales should I trust the theory predictions, even before I start comparing it with observations? So about the theories of modified gravity, the ones that I'm going to talk about is massive gravity. And the basic idea is the following. If you give the graviton a mass, you're basically giving a finite range to the gravitational force. So if you do that, it could explain why gravity is becoming weaker at the present cosmological scales and the universe is under current accelerated expansion. So basically, besides the 1 over r usual profile, we also have a Yukawa suppression factor that is making the gravitational potential decay even faster. So if we use cosmology to motivate this idea that the graviton might have a mass, then the range of gravity becomes more or less of order of the inverse of the graviton mass. And if we use cosmology to constrain that value, then it could be of order of the Hubble scale. So those are ideas which are cosmological motivated, but already from a theoretical viewpoint, we can think about massive gravity as a theory on its own right. It's a theory of a massive spin two particle. And for us to even write down that theory, it's quite complicated. So already at the linear level, whenever we have a mass term, we need to write it in a way so that it doesn't give rise to ghosts, at least at the classical level. And this structure is already quite, it's the so-called Fitts-Pauli structure. It's already non-trivial. At the nonlinear level, it becomes really, really complicated. We need to write interactions in a very specific way so as not to excite any ghost and to recover basically GR in an appropriate limit, in particular when the mass vanishes. And there's been a set of historical setbacks that try to figure out the nonlinear completion, which has only very recently been proposed to be a ghost-free extension of this Fitts-Pauli mass term. Now, the fact that it's a theory on its own right and that it has cosmological applications, like what I said before, makes it very appealing for cosmologists. So even though it's quite hard from the theoretical point of view, it means that there's a lot of benefits in trying to use cosmology to actually constrain these theories of modified gravity. So this talk is really going to gravitate around two main ideas. So how can we test gravity theories with theory itself? What kind of tests can we devise in our theories, even before we start comparing our predictions with observations? And how can we use cosmology to constrain gravity? What kind of observables should we be looking for now that we have access to so many of them, for example, from the CMB observables? So the roadmap of this talk is as follows. So I'm going to start reviewing some effective field theory principles. So I'm going to argue that for massive gravity and other theories, we actually require certain redressing of what we call effective field theories. Then I'm going to talk about some aspects of massive gravity theories, and I'm going to focus on the so-called Weinstein effect that relies on very large interactions. And that's going to be very relevant for the consistency of the theory, both at the classical and the quantum level. And then I'm going to discuss some cosmological applications. So how can we use massive gravity to basically have some predictions for observations, but also how can we use observations to try and constrain massive gravity? And then I'm going to give a very short summary for the talk. So effective field theories are really widely known in field theory and in cosmology and also in particle physics. So what they are is basically a systematic parametrization of interactions at low energies, which are all compatible with a given symmetry that we impose in the theory. So the reason why they're effective is actually twofold. First of all, they rely on the so-called decoupling limit. So if I want to study low energy subprocesses, I shouldn't have to worry about what happens at high energy physics. And so I can use that theory to make predictive constraints about observables without having to care about high energy completion. So for example, if we throw a ball here, we shouldn't have to care about what happens in Jupiter and Saturn, because we're talking about completely different scales in the problem. And the other point is that they also rely on a finite number of operators to describe that physics, or at least in a compact structure. And we're going to see explicit examples of that. So if we write the Lagrangian, we start with a low energy description Lagrangian, and then we add a couple of interactions, which are all suppressed by the strong coupling scale lambda there. So the whole idea is that those interactions are really suppressed. I can't make the operator O very large without ruining the whole effective field theory description of the theory. It starts going out of control. So we say that these operators are technically irrelevant, but they're also unimportant because I can't make them large. And usually we say that they can be protected against large quantum effects if there is this asymmetry that protects these Lagrangian against these large quantum corrections. So in theories like massive gravity, we need to redress our understanding of effective field theories. So they rely on large derivative interactions where that operator O actually becomes quite large compared to the strong coupling scale. And then our task is to try and make sense of an effective field theory which is built out of such operators. So a specific example is, for example, DBI. So DBI is basically a square root, and that square root is summing an infinite number of operators. It's like an infinite expansion. So if this is a strong coupling scale, this is the Lagrangian in DBI. So basically it relies on an expanding an infinite number of terms, like a series of x. We can also have power law models like x to the power of n, where n is very large, and we want to make sure that that x is actually the dominant interaction and n is very large. So we're really looking at very large self-interactions. Another example, which we're going to play with a little bit to understand all these concepts, is the cubic Galilean. So in the cubic Galilean, we basically have a second order derivative that multiplies the usual kinetic term, and we want to work with large background configurations. So usually we would have said, well, box phi needs to be much smaller than lambda cubed for us to make sense of this theory. But we're actually going to work with theories where the background is so large that the box phi is actually comparable or even larger than the relevant power of the strong coupling scale. So this is said that we rely on large derivative interactions. So we're looking at the so-called Weinstein effect, where the nonlinearities become so important that they're going to redress all that we mean about irrelevant operators. So for us to source large background configurations, we need these Galilean to couple to matter. So let's suppose a spherically symmetric source that is basically matter with a given mass. What happens when the Galilean couples to this matter source? So basically it can acquire a very large background configuration. So if we solve for the equations of motion, what we find is a different field profile that this field can have. And if we study this system for small enough distance scales, and small enough is going to be clear in a second, what we find is that the field profile is such that the box of phi over there is really much larger than lambda cubed. So that means that if we calculate the perturbations in this theory, then the kinetic term is not going for the perturbations, is not going to be dominated anymore by the first term there in the Lagrangian, but it's going to receive very large corrections from the interactions as well. And small enough distances here really mean below the so-called Weinstein radius. So the Weinstein radius is going to separate between the linear and the nonlinear behavior. The nonlinear means that interactions are going to start dominating the behavior of the system. So if we split the field into background plus perturbations, we need to canonically normalize the field because now perturbations are no longer leaving with a canonical kinetic term, And once we do that, this is basically what we find. What we find is that the interactions are going to come in at an energy scale, which is no longer lambda, but it's going to be a redress scale. And this redressing depends on what the environment of the background is doing. So depending on how I'm coupling the Galilean to matter, I can have very large background configurations. And instead of having lambda, what I have is something that is much larger than lambda. So what this means is that the strong coupling scale, which is a concept that is dependent on the environment, is actually going to increase much larger than what I would have thought the scale to be at which perturbative unitarity would be lost. So what this means is that if we start with a lambda, then if we couple the Galilean to something that is quite big, it acquires a very large background configuration. And so the perturbative unitarity is not going to be broken at lambda, but rather at lambda star. And this can still be smaller than the cutoff scale. So the cutoff scale is the ultimate energy scale at which the theory provides reliable predictions. So it could be estimated, for example, to be the mass of a ghost that can come in the theory. It could be the lightest particle that hasn't been included in this particle spectrum. There are several ways of estimating that cutoff. But the whole point is that that cutoff, whatever it is, it's fixed.
So this is a way to make this respectable theory is respectable, because it's not renormalizable, it has ghosts.
Right, so that's the whole point, that this theory in principle is going to have ghosts. So what we're going to care about is the scale at which that ghost is going to come in the theory. It could be that it actually appears on energy scales that are so high that I can't probe with this effective field theory description. So I'm going to discuss that later on in one specific slide.
Is there something worrying about already?
Why tachyonic?
So I can choose, by taking conventional matter, I can make T the positive. That's something that's roughly tachyonic. I would think I could make it managing negative energy configurations if I did that. You know, some coupling that doesn't have that kind of problem?
So here I'm just assuming a standard minimal coupling. So I'm not considering something that is flipping the energy density sign. So just a way of reorganizing these effective field theories is the following. You start with a low energy description where you put all your relevant interactions, and then you have all your irrelevant ones, which are relying on these self interactions being quite large. So if, for example, on those operators, you only have first order derivatives acting on the scalar field, those could be P of X models, like, for example, this one. You can also have Galileans, like the ones that are dominated by the box phi type of operators. And those can be large. So even though they're technically irrelevant, they're going to be important as far as the dynamics of the theory goes. And then they're going to include truly suppressed interactions compared to the strong coupling scale. So the whole reorganization, just to summarize once again, is that usually in traditional effective field theories, what we have is the suppression of some operators by some energy scale. And then if we're only interested in low energy physics, we shouldn't have to worry about what happens at high energy physics, and those operators are going to be very much suppressed. And on the other hand, we can actually have on these theories a redressing of what we mean by large and by small. So what we care is about the number of derivatives that are actually acting on the scalar field. And what we want is to define a hierarchy between these derivatives. And which derivatives matter are basically going to depend on this theory. So for example, here, X here is basically the kinetic term, so I care about this operator being almost as large as one. So I care about first order derivatives being large, and this theory is okay, provided that subsequent high order derivatives are small. For the Galilean, we care about second order derivatives being quite large, provided that all high order derivatives are small. And of course, there are several questions that we can ask about what desirable properties an effective field theory should have. So we could focus, for example, on the quantum corrections. Where do quantum corrections come in this theory? And do they spoil our effective field theory description or not? We could ask ourselves, are the causal structure of this theory well defined? Are we only dealing with ghost-free interactions? And if there appears a ghost, what's the energy scale at which that ghost appears? And we want, in principle, all our interactions to be local. That could be a desirable property as well. So at least for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to focus on the stability under radiative corrections. And what I want to argue is that by studying the quantum stability, we're actually able to predict different ways that these theories can couple to gravity. I think it can be regarded as a reorganized effective field theory as well. So we can make H relatively large. And if you want the usual sense, then we need to compare it with a curvature. And then the wall reorganization is going to be with regards to that. So rather than just looking at the geodesic motion and so on.
What if we eventually were able to do experiments like primordial gravitational waves?
Right, that would be interesting because we would have a problem. That's definitely true. Yeah, so we will need a better understanding of how these theories would work. Absolutely.
The Holy Grail
would be fun. Well, you're just trying to think of a sensible effective field theory, not worrying about the ultimate UV.
She says data is the king. So I'm giving you data.
So,
if I said two were correct,
yeah,
then we would be in physics.
We would have to understand how effective field theories are constructed. That's true. I don't think it's just a problem of these kind of theories. It would be a problem of effective field theories in general.
I have to worry about where this kind of comes in, because the LHC is going up to 14 TeV.
Right, so we don't know what the cutoff precisely is. We can try and estimate what the cutoff is. It could be the Planck scale, it could be below that. We don't know what the cutoff is. So we're talking about infrared modifications of gravity, and you could ask, why would I care about quantum corrections which come in from ultraviolet divergences? And actually, if we're trying to describe the cosmological constant by introducing these infrared modifications of gravity, if we have any hope of trying to address the cosmological constant problem, then surely any alternative to this lambda should be able to address this question as well. So whatever we propose in terms of the theory, it should also be stable against quantum effects. So there are several ways in which quantum effects can basically ruin your effective field theory description. So one way is whether the coefficients of the interactions are technically unnatural. So if the coefficients are basically changed by quantum corrections, then we need to take that into account because all the predictions can be tied to those coefficients. So all predictions for observables are changing depending whether I'm going to tune the coefficients differently or not. And the other point is whether they generate other operators that we initially didn't take into account. So if that happens, then we're basically going to be introducing other operators which the classical Lagrangian hasn't taken into account. So if we pick up a theory and we want to make a one-loop statement, the theory should be okay, provided that the classical Lagrangian is much larger than all the operators that we're generating by quantum corrections. So how do we calculate the so-called one-loop effective action for these kind of theories? So we start by splitting the field into a background field and perturbations, and then we want to calculate what's the kinetic structure that those quantum fluctuations are going to feel. So basically, we focus on the kinetic term, and the Z mu nu, which is the kinetic matrix, is going to be basically the main object whenever we're going to calculate quantum corrections. So in principle, we would like to covariantize this answer. So instead of just working with Z mu nu, we can work with what we call an effective metric that has the appropriate factor of the measure. So if we do that, we can calculate the one-loop effective action, which basically means that the exponential of that action is going to be given by the functional determinant of the Z mu nu, grad mu, grad nu. So how do we calculate this object that seems extremely complicated? It is complicated, but these UV divergences have already been organized as a series of powers of the curvature by Barvinsky and Vilkovitsky and also Avramidi, in which basically they can go order by order in terms of what they can call the power law divergences and then focus on the logs. And if we use dimensional regularization, by which we only focus on logarithmic running of these corrections, then this is the answer. So basically, we're writing what kind of operators we can generate by focusing on curvature quantities which appear in this combination. And these curvature quantities are going to be built explicitly out of the effective metric. So the interpretation is the following. If we compare the quantum Lagrangian or the quantum mechanically induced operators that come into the Lagrangian with the classical ones, what we want is to make sure that the local curvature defined in field space remains very, very small. So we're not introducing quantum effects which can be so large that they can change the operator structure. And this calculation can be done without invoking anything specific about the symmetry. So it's true that by quantum corrections, as a point of principle, we're going to generate operators which are compatible with that symmetry. But at least in this calculation, we don't have to invoke that symmetry. So how do we do this in a specific case? Let's look at the Galilean. Even without doing a specific calculation, we can see the origin of the derivative structure, derivative hierarchy that I mentioned before. So let's suppose that we start with the cubic Galilean up there. If we calculate the kinetic structure that the fluctuations are going to feel, it's basically going to depend on a constant bit in Z and also on the box phi over lambda cubed. Now, what we've said is that we care about the curvature quantities built out of the effective metric, which is, again, conformally related with this Z. So what we care is about this effective metric G mu nu. So by construction, it depends already on second-order derivatives of the scalar field. So any curvature quantities built out of this is going to depend at least on third-order derivatives acting on the scalar field. So if we can make sure that we're in a region in the field space where the second-order derivative is large, but subsequent derivatives are small, like those that enter in the curvature, then we're able to develop a well-defined and consistent effective field theory. So the quantum corrections are under control, even when we have very large background configurations of order of the strong coupling scale, provided that any third-order derivative or higher is suppressed by this strong coupling scale. So how does the Weinstein screening effect works here? So Weinstein screening means that the large interactions are really very active and they're protecting your theory. So I didn't discuss the role of this in the classical level, but basically the Weinstein effect is able to recover the usual general relativity result from these massive gravity theories. But also at the quantum level, what we see is a Weinstein screening effect. In what sense? So the Weinstein radius is basically separating the linear and the nonlinear regime in these interactions. The nonlinear means that the interactions are going to be quite large. And we can make sense of this theory even inside the nonlinear regime, so inside the Weinstein radius, because the quantum effects are going to be suppressed by these large interactions, by this large Z that is going to basically protect your quantum fluctuations. So there's going to be, the advantage of this approach is that by the one loop effective action, we can calculate what's the minimum distance scale at which quantum effects are going to be so large that the theory is no longer protected against those. So it gives us a handle on what the theory error can be and what the energy scales or the distance scales can be when the theory really runs out of control. So just to summarize, the method is quite generic and accounts for all the one loop effects. So we're considering self-interactions, so only fields are running inside the loops. The results seem to be quite robust for all the theories that are exhibiting these large derivative interactions. And of course, it's possible to do a little bit better because this is a one loop result. So if you want to talk a little bit about it, I'm happy at the end of the talk, but then I won't have time to tell you about other exciting things. So. Right. So we didn't apply this to solitons, but maybe it will be an interesting way to study the stability of those theories. So the higher order loops would be in principle a problem. So that's why we need to use the so-called dynamical renormalization group equation. And what we find is that deep inside the Weinstein radius, the redressing occurs is so powerful that it's basically suppressing all the large quantum corrections that we could have.
To all
orders. To all orders. That's right. But it's a very non-trivial effect, because we need to focus, for us to solve the Wettrich equation, which is quite hard, we need to focus deep inside the Weinstein radius. So let's try and apply this to massive gravity. So this is the Lagrangian in massive gravity, which is quite complicated. So it's built out of interactions which are explicitly Gauss-free. So square brackets here represent the trace of the quantity inside there. So at each order in X, there's a finite number and very specific interactions that need to come in. And so what I'd like you to focus on is that if these interactions here receive large quantum corrections that detune the way that the interactions are appearing at each order in the Lagrangian, that can introduce a ghost in the theory. And the question is, at what scale is that ghost going to come in? So massive gravity is basically this large name for a class of theories. If F mu nu, which is the second metric that appears there, is fixed and is taken to be Minkowski, then it's not dynamical, and we have what we usually call massive gravity. If F mu nu acquires a kinetic term, which is the Einstein-Hilbert term, then we actually have two dynamical metrics that we need to work with. So given this Lagrangian, what happens when I take into account quantum corrections? So there's basically several things that can happen. Either we detune the alpha tilde n coefficients and make them, for example, technically unnatural, or we break the Gauss-free structure, or we introduce other operators which should have already been there and that hadn't been taken into account in the classical action. So there are several ways in which this theory can be spoiled by quantum corrections. So let's suppose that we calculate the three-point function in this theory, and let's focus on massive gravity. So F mu nu is basically fixed and frozen to be Minkowski. We need to calculate several Feynman diagrams. So if we calculate, for example, the three-point function, what we find is that the interactions come in a way that the Gauss-free structure is destabilized. So in principle, that can be very worrisome. So if we calculate that amplitude, and if we focus on the elasticity zero mode of the graviton, what happens is that the energy scales at which the ghost comes in can be made arbitrarily small. So we're looking at backgrounds that are very large, like before. So the elasticity zero mode, which is pi zero there, the box of pi zero can be much larger than lambda three. And so if that happens, we're introducing a ghost at unacceptably low scales. So in principle, this can be very bad. But the real question is, we're already making interactions so large, so doesn't this cause a redressing, like we argued before, of the effective field theory itself? And the reason is that it does. So if in the one loop effective action we take into account that redressing, what we find is that indeed it looks like the mass of the ghost is going to be quite small, but it's actually, there's going to be a suppression because of the Feinstein screening effect. So what happens is that Z there is very, very large. So that's basically raising the scale at which the ghost is appearing in your theory. So this is a way of seeing the screening entering within the quantum loops. So if we focus on the one loop effective action, we can indeed show that it becomes completely under control compared to the classical one. But this is a non-trivial effect, and that relies again on these large derivative self-interactions. So the graviton mass, as well as the interaction coefficients that appear, are all technically natural. So if we start with a small value, quantum corrections are not able to give large quantum effects. So these are only loops of gravitons themselves. What happens when we couple this theory to gravity? So if we consider a GR graviton on the outside and we start calculating basically endpoint functions of this quantity, and if we consider that matter runs inside the loops, this matter has no knowledge whatsoever about the mass of the graviton. The only propagator that is inside that loop is the propagator of matter. So it doesn't have knowledge about the graviton mass. So whatever I get at one loop and then higher order loops in terms of the coupling of matter to GR is exactly the same answer that I should get with a massive graviton. that is coupling to gravity. So here at lowest order in the curvature, the only term that I can generate is basically a cosmological constant at the level of the Lagrangian. So if I do the same exercise with a graviton that has some non-zero mass, the result needs to be exactly the same. So when we couple these theories to matter and we only consider matter running inside the loops, the only terms that we can generate are cosmological constants. And so by construction, those are Gauss free terms. So whenever we have bigravity, we can imagine either coupling the metric G to matter, and that generates a cosmological constant by quantum effects, or we can imagine coupling the metric F to gravity, sorry, to matter. And so that generates a cosmological constant for the F metric. So can we devise some non-trivial coupling between involving these two different metrics, both G and F, such that they couple to matter, but they don't generate a ghost, which you can probe within your effective field theory? Or in other words, how can we use what we know about quantum corrections in massive gravity to constrain the way that these theories can couple to matter? So now I'm going to discuss a little bit about the cosmology in these theories, focusing on two different things. How the quantum corrections, which is a theory-motivated exercise, can tell you how these theories couple to matter, and so how you can basically conclude something about the cosmology in these theories, and how can you use the cosmology to constrain the graviton mass. So there's basically a cycle going on. So one of the things that is known in massive gravity is that there's no known FRW cosmological solutions if we take F mu nu to be basically the flat metric. And that's because there's basically a breaking of diff invariance, and you're not able to have a dynamical equation for the evolution of the scale factor. So what I like to argue is that there's still other possibilities. So knowing how gravity is going to couple to matter can help you to construct a coupling so that maybe such solutions are still possible. So let's suppose that we want to use the fact that by the quantum corrections, we know what kind of terms we can generate. Suppose that we impose in our theory that quantum corrections are only able to generate terms which we've already written down in the potential, in the classical Lagrangian. So we can write that cosmological constant, which is square root of G effective, as one of the terms that appears in the potential. And it has been shown that a specific combination is this. So if I write the effective metric is built out when A and B are constant coefficients, is made out of the G mu nu metric as well as the F mu nu metric in a highly non-trivial way. And we know that quantum mechanically, this is perfectly safe, because what we're doing is basically generating Gauss-free interactions at the level of the Lagrangian. So it's true that interaction coefficients, which are sitting outside those interactions, they can change, but not the Gauss-free structure. And it seems that it's quite hard to have viable alternatives to this effective coupling, but this is still work in progress. So the question you can ask, so quantum mechanically, this coupling is fine because you're constructing it in a way that it doesn't give rise to ghosts, but does it pass all the tests? In particular, does it pass all the classical tests? And the answer is no. If we consider highly anisotropic backgrounds, the ghost is going to come in. But again, if we consider very smooth backgrounds, the ghost is not going to be probed by the effective field theory. And we are able to do cosmology around those backgrounds, and it's still perfectly well defined at the energy scale lambda. So this theory has cosmological applications, and presumably one of the most relevant ones is that the no-go result for FRW cosmology is actually going to be evaded by this effective metric. So how do we show that? Suppose that you start with the action in which you have a massive gravity interaction, you have the usual standard model fields, and then you couple this effective metric to a dark sector. It could be the inflaton, it could be dark matter, it could be something of that sort. Now choose a specific metric for your dynamical metric. So suppose that you have basically the lapse there and you have an FRW background configuration. What we find is that the evolution of the scale factor is non-trivial. So if either A or B in capital letters are zero, which would be just the usual coupling of massive gravity to matter, then the right-hand side would be zero, and the scale factor couldn't be dynamical. But introducing this composite metric, which is built out of F mu nu and G mu nu, if A and B are both non-vanishing, the right-hand side would also be non-vanishing. And the whole point is that we're going to have an evolution equation for the scale factor. So FRW cosmological solutions would be possible within this theory. And the Friedmann equation is going to be slightly changed. So it's going to depend on several ways in the scale factor. So we're going to have several components in the universe which are going to evolve differently from ordinary matter. So they're going to redshift in a slightly different way.
Sorry, what is A tilde?
So A tilde is a redefined scale factor, and N tilde is also a redefined lapse. So they're going to include information about the capital A and the capital B. But the whole point is that they're going to redshift with A in a slightly different way, all these components. So the cosmology would be non-trivial in that case. So I'll just like to tell you a little bit something about that we've been looking at and we're quite excited about. And the question that I like to ask is, what does the CMB actually know about the graviton mass? So if we know the theory and we're able to constrain that theory, then we're saying that we can design ways of this theory coupling to matter and then constrain it with observations. But we can also ask ourselves, what observables can we use to constrain the parameters in this theory? And in particular, what kind of CMB observables can we use to learn a little bit about the graviton mass, if indeed the graviton has a mass? So if we focus, for example, on gravitational waves, then we know that the spectrum should be different, because basically the dispersion relation is going to be different if we introduce a mass scale. And it's already been known that if you give the graviton a mass, then the spectrum is going to be slightly changed. So for example, in massive gravity, if you make the splitting of G mu nu in terms of a background configuration, Minkowski, plus fluctuations which develop on that background, and if you calculate the quadratic action, you basically get the same result as in GR, but then you get an extra term. And that extra term has to do with the effective mass of that graviton that multiplies the several parameters of the theory. So as a point of principle, if you increase that mass sufficiently, you know that the power spectrum of gravitational waves is going to start oscillating and it's going to decrease. So if you are able to measure the amplitude of primordial gravitational waves, you can basically have a hint of how large the graviton mass can be. So that's a way of naively getting into the way of gravitational waves actually constraining the parameters of the theory. In bigravity, it seems that it's a much richer parameter space. So let's suppose that we decompose both the metric G and the metric F in perturbations. So what are the gravitational waves in a theory like this? In principle, it's going to be quite complicated. So H is going to have its own kinetic term, L is going to have its own kinetic term, then there's going to be several interactions between all these metric perturbations, and in total, 7 degrees of freedom. But if we're able to diagonalize this system into appropriate variables, then we can separate the description in terms of a massless mode that counts 2 degrees of freedom, and so there's no effect coming from the mass of the graviton here. And then there's going to be a massive mode where this m squared effective is indeed related to the graviton mass. So if we measure this signal, then we'll be able to constrain this effective mass, which can be much larger than we had anticipated. So this is a way of having alternative ways of having cosmology to constrain these theories. Usually we argue that we need late-time cosmology to constrain theories like massive gravity, but it's actually possible to also have early-time cosmology to constrain, provide constraints for these theories. And if we calculate the tensor to scalar ratio in these theories, what we find is that we can separate it into basically two contributions. There's going to be the usual contribution from GR, and there's going to be a small contribution coming from massive gravity. And you can understand that the more massive the graviton is, then the more reduced that power spectrum is going to be. And you can compensate that by the contribution coming from that massless mode. So the graviton mass can be actually quite large, for example, at the time of recombination, and it can evolve in time, without these theories being ruled out.
So in the present cosmology, the data, you have to get the expansion of the universe correct.
Right.
And also the structure code. It's very sensitive to changes at the feeding equation.
Yes.
And you have to fit the antiparticle spectrum, which is now about 1% accuracy.
So what I'm trying to say is that those are late time constraints that we can impose. And what I'm arguing is that there's a lot more constraints that we can also use. So these theories can be made quite constrained if you want to use the phenomenology to study these theories. There's lots of tests that we can impose in these theories, and this would be one of them.
So the CFP is not a worry.
I'm saying that these theories can evade the early time just because of this simple rule. So this is during inflation, because we're producing these gravitational waves. So this is just a primordial signal, that's right. So we're not looking at, yes, that's right. So I'm basically giving a complementary viewpoint of what you can constrain the theory. So these are plots by Dubofsky and collaborators. And basically what they found is that as you increase the graviton mass that is here symbolically represented by mu, you can find a plateau in the power spectrum of gravitational waves. So if you ever observe that kind of plateau, it could be a hint of the graviton mass. So I don't have too much time to go into details, but this is still work in progress. So let me just quickly summarize the talk. So I started with giving an overview of how effective field theories can be used as a toolkit to try and understand cosmological theories and massive gravity theories in particular. So with these one loop effects, what we've shown is that we can still make sense of these theories that rely on large derivative self interactions, provided that quantum corrections are only able to generate operators which are not only technically irrelevant, but also unimportant. And with these kind of calculations, we're able to get an estimate of how far in small scales we can trust the theory. We're able to say up to which energy scales we should trust the theory predictions. So the range of scales in this effective field theory becomes more well-defined. At least we have a handle at the ultimate energy scales that we can trust these predictions. And in principle, all these statements that I've said about the presence of symmetries and the magnitude of the quantum effects are going to be generic statements to theories that rely on large derivative interactions, and so where the Weinstein effect is active. Then I also discussed the fact that this Weinstein mechanism is actually protecting your theory against large quantum corrections. So it's a way of basically inserting this highly nonlinearity even inside the loops. The graviton mass can be constrained not only by late-time cosmology, which is the usual statement in massive gravity, if we expect massive gravity to provide a dynamical explanation of the current accelerated expansion of the universe, but we can also use early time cosmology. So we can use primordial gravitational wave signal.
So in a gravity model, the gravity one is the excitation of which of the two matrix.
That's right.
What do you define as a graviton and a bigraviton?
So we don't have two gravitons, we only have one graviton, but we basically have these two sets of modes. And then we can decompose that into a massive component and a massless one. Okay. So that was the diagonalized basis that I was referring to. So we can still probe that mass just by looking at that analysis. So in bigravity models, what happens is that the graviton mass can be much larger than we had anticipated, because we also have the contribution from the massless modes, which is the usual GR. So that could completely compensate the contribution from the massive modes. So let me leave you with the names of my collaborators and also with the references for our work. Thank you very much.
If you have a biometric theory, you have extra degrees of freedom, which you know.
Right.
So if you look at the binary pulse sample, it's very restrictive. It excludes monopole, dipole radiation, so high degree of levels.
Right.
So in fact, biometric theories like Rosen biometric theory excluded. What happens? This must impose a condition.
So I haven't looked at the binary pulsar constraints on these theories. But it's possible that, that it can already impose such constraints on the parameters of the theory, absolutely.
Because the extra degrees of freedom of amplitude, 1, 4, 5,
right.
In the window. And in my opinion, I find the binary pulsar data is more restrictive than the physiological data.
It's entirely possible, yeah. I think what I want to argue is exactly that you can devise so many constraints in these theories that even before they meet experiment and they meet observations, there's already on the theory level many constraints that we can devise, like the way that that theory couples to matter.
My second question is, this is my last question. What do I get from all of this? Because you have to go to a lot of trouble to get this
right.
What do I gain?
Well, my point of view is that there's many positive things. So first of all, even if GR works very well, we need alternatives because in science, if we only have one theory, then it's just basically, you know, one theory that we can get observations. So we definitely need you know, alternatives. On the other side, from the theory point of view, I think these theories are really, really very rich. So even cosmologically, they have like very rich predictions for observables. So these kind of theories, we can use them to the early universe to explain, you know, basically models of inflation. But we can also use them for modified gravity. So the fact that these effective field theory constructions, they allow us to describe periods completely different in the history of the universe, from my viewpoint, makes our understanding of these theories really, really useful. We learn a lot about how these theories can work as effective field theories. The wall redressing effect is something that I think was better understood when Galileans came in. And you can use Galilean inflation, but you can use Galileans also for modified gravity. So I think that's quite useful. And I think from a theoretical viewpoint already, it's something that is a valid question. If we give the graviton a mass, or if the mass is non-vanishing, what happens to the theoretical description that we have of the universe? And we have the cosmological constant problem. We don't really know how to tackle it. And it could be that these theories are not the answer. But at least we're trying to use them as a playground to understand more about gravity. So I think already on that viewpoint, it's already quite useful. What I discuss... So here I was looking at corrections that are actually renormalizing cosmological constants. So it's not solving the running of the cosmological constant in that sense. But there are specific theories of massive gravity that can attempt to describe dynamical solutions to the cosmological constant problem. I haven't touched that issue here, though. If there's any hope, I guess, of trying to tackle that issue, then we need to explore theories like this.
We've lost our chair.
Kurt.
So we need to have knowledge. I mean, it's maybe it's an unfair question, but I think it's an honest question. What's your personal best bet for graviton mass? What's your personal best bet for graviton mass if you had to put more money on a value?
Right. So I guess the beauty of these analyses is that if you use present constraints and if you use more or less the Hubble scale today to explain it, then we know that the graviton mass should be something around the order of 10 to the minus 33 electron volt or even smaller. But if you use gravitational waves, they place a constraint on the graviton mass or what would be the effective graviton mass that you would see at the time of recombination. So that could give you a window. Because as a point of principle, the way that you're probing the graviton mass, it could possibly depend on time. It could be a scale of a function, basically, of the scale factor, for example. So what this seems to indicate is that there's actually some kind of degree of freedom that you can play with and that you can probe these theories at completely different times. So it's hard to see exactly what values you could have. But it could be that even on early times, you actually get competitive bounds compared with the late time physics. So if you only have one single mode, like the case of massive gravity and not bigravity, then you only have one parameter mass. But if you have bigravity, you have more degree of freedom. So it could be that these theories are already restricted, or it could be that they have more degree of freedom. It's hard to see which way it's going to go, but yeah.
You'll never observe this graviton. You will never observe
the graviton?
Not with the mass of the electron.
Yeah, we need to find other observational constraints, other observables. Right.
But even classically, you can have small or even zero contributions to the action, which make them major in the physics. So what's the rest of the argument for yourself?
So this argument is quite loose. I made a precise statement, which was, at the level of the quantum corrections, you need to make sure that either you don't introduce a ghost, and so you still preserve the ghost-free structure, or you don't introduce operators, which are still technically irrelevant but important compared with the classical. So whenever you compare the classical Lagrangian with the one loop, this is a way of you to estimate what the energy scales you can use that effective field theory for.
I mean, you can argue it's a necessary condition, I suppose, but I don't know that it's a sufficient condition.
It might not be, especially if you get energy scales and you find that all of a sudden you can't actually probe regions inside the Weinstein radius, for example. It could happen. This is an exploration of what are the constraints that you can impose in the theory at level of the quantum corrections for you to trust it. It could be that there's a more rigorous approach, but this is the way that we're starting with the one loop effective action, which already provides a hint of what those energy scales are, or the distance scales that we should be able to trust the theory.